welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 23rd of November 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's another beautiful autumnal day in Blighty here. It's the start of another week, and who better to start the week with than myself and my guest today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, or good afternoon, rather, as it is. I'm very well indeed, actually, and looking forward to another week of productive effort, actually, because I think that these podcasts that we're putting out are well received by a very wide audience, and I'm planning this week to significantly increase my output in writing again, and so that will be good.
Excellent, excellent. That is good to hear. Of course, we remind listeners that you have your Western Spring website. It contains lots of articles and guest writers and all sorts of things like that. And you're right, the show does go down very well, particularly the Greatest Britons section. We've got another one of them that we will begin today. But before we get into that, we've got some news to get into. We've got a few news stories here that were fairly important last week. And the main one that has been going on all over the weekend are the claims of Priti Patel bullying the civil service. And we've talked about this a little bit before in the past, how ridiculous it is to assert that she's barely above 4 foot tall. This barely above 4 foot tall Indian woman has somehow been bullying 6 foot tall civil servants. It's just absolutely ridiculous. And Priti Patel, for an Indian, I think she's pretty good for an Indian. She does seem to be fairly conservative minded. But she shouldn't be our Home Secretary. What we really should be talking about is her record as Home Secretary. And though she claimed she was going to stop immigration, she hasn't stopped immigration. I think at the moment we've got something like 50,000 illegal fake immigrants, fake asylum seekers who came across on boats across the channel that are being put up in hotels and in army barracks. And she presided over that. She hasn't stopped the immigration. She allowed the Black Lives Matter riots to take place this summer. And these are far more important things than whether she swears or not at the civil servants. And to be quite honest, I'm quite happy she did get angry at the civil servants, because they need somebody to be speaking to them in that way. They need to buck their ideas up, basically. They need to report on this grooming gang report for a start, which is apparently where these problems came in. She got quite angry and swore at them because they wouldn't let her have a look at the grooming gang report. But just to say that people are being bullied by this 4 foot tall woman is just ridiculous. And all the Tories have gathered around her, and they've all been sickly sweet in their tweets. And apparently they've all been ordered to come out and say what a lovely woman Priti Patel is. But as I say, really, we have to look at her record, and her record is not very good. I'm sure she's very nice as an Indian lady, but as a Home Secretary, I don't think she's really any better than Theresa May, which I'm sure the Civic Nationalists don't want to hear. They think she's rather good at what she does, but I don't think she is at all. Max, have you had any thoughts on the Priti Patel bullying accusations over the weekend?
Well, you're quite right that somebody who's small in stature shouldn't really be accused of bullying in the traditional sense of the word, although quite obviously Priti Patel, if she is engaging in bullying, wouldn't be bullying people on the basis of her physical might. She would be bullying them on the basis of her authority as Home Secretary and her ability to sack them, presumably. Now, whether she's done that or not, I don't really know. But the fact of the matter is that the wokerati, those people who are on the liberal left in our society, are always prattling on about bullying as if bullying is something which is completely unnatural in our society. But I mean, the fact of the matter is that we get endless discussion about bullying at school, about bullying online. Well, if somebody's bullying you online, all you do is you just turn your computer off, or you just go to a different website and and move away from them. You know, somebody can't actually really bully you unless you allow yourself to be bullied online. As far as schools are concerned, children, if they are allowed to interact together, they will always try to assert a pecking order. You know, if you've got a group of boys, that group of boys will get up to all sorts of activities. And in getting up to those activities, there will be rivalries between the boys that want to be in charge and the boys that want to oppose them and want to be in charge instead. And so what happens is that you have the odd fight or the odd bit of the ruction between the two rival individuals, and eventually they settle their differences, and one of them decides that they're going to be subordinate to the other, and peace then reigns, or they continue their squabble between the two of them until eventually it is settled. But the fact of the matter is that you can't stop bullying in schools, and you can't stop bullying really in the workplace. In my experience of having worked at a number of levels in commercial organisations, is that lots of bosses bully the people who are beneath them, and again, it's to some extent a bit like the playground, where people are bullied as much as they allow themselves to be bullied. And if you stand up for yourself and you spit in the eye of the person who's trying to bully you, then they will not be able to bully you. I mean, I can remember an instance where I was a manager of an office, and my immediate boss rang me and ordered me to do something which I regarded as completely stupid. And I can remember saying to him, "Sorry, I'm not going to do that." And him saying, "You don't understand, I'm ordering you to do it." And I just said, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that because blah, 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 blah." And him saying, "You don't understand, I'm ordering you to do it," and getting extremely annoyed about that. And I ended up getting a formal written warning as a result of it. But the point is that if you stand up for yourself, then you can resist bullying. And well, I think for civil servants to whinge and whine about Priti Patel bullying them is a bit soppy, really.
Yeah, they're just trying. They don't want to change there. They want to be the ones that call the shots. That's what it boils down to. They're not happy that somebody has come in there and told them that, that there's going to be some changes. She is conservative minded, but obviously she's going to be predisposed more to helping her own kind out than she is helping the British. She has pushed a bit of a diversity agenda. She said that all the ministers have to go on mandatory diversity awareness courses and things like that, but yet at the same time she's also has been quite good for the police, I think. And we've also had this other black lady, I forget her name, a black MP that spoke out and said that the schools shouldn't be teaching Black Lives Matter, not without any context, and they shouldn't be promoting that. So we do see these little signs of the Conservatives trying to be conservative, but then they just make themselves look absolutely ridiculous when they start whining about bullying within the civil service. We've also had other ridiculous things last week. We had Neil Basue, the head of the counter-terrorism squad, or anti-terrorism squad in the Metropolitan Police, and he was wheeled out at the end of the week to say that he thinks that we should be asking whether people putting out anti-vaccination information should be criminalised or not. And at the start of the week, they were saying that the social media companies need to do more about this. They need to prevent this information being available on their social media sites. Halfway through the week, we then started hearing from the campaign against online hate or words to that effect, and all the anti-Islamophobia types and the anti-hate speech types who are getting in on the act and saying, well, we need to get rid of this anti-vax information. And then finally, at the end of the week, we have an anti-terrorist officer, the head of anti-terrorism, saying that something needs to be done about these anti-vaxxers. And I think where it's heading is they're going to put alternative medical information, they're going to put that on the same footing as hate speech and claim that this is somehow a threat to people. It's doing violence to people, in the same way that they say that words are somehow causing actual violence to people. They're going to do the same thing with this anti-vax information. And, you know, I couldn't believe it that they actually had this Neil Basu coming out saying this. I mean, it was just laughable. I mean, it's just so predictable. And it really blows a hole in this idea that hate speech is the reason why we have these hate speech laws, is to protect the feelings of the minorities, because they could be so hurt by hearing these critical words that their soul could be crushed, and they will never dream again of getting a job in the civil service or whatever. And that's the reason why we're told we shouldn't have hate speech or criticism of them, or it encourages others to go out and beat ethnic minorities up. This is a sort of logic. But if they're going to start including alternative medical information in with that as well, then how does alternative medical information cause people to have hurt feelings or incite people to violence? It doesn't. It doesn't at all. And what that does is it says that what this is all really about is trying to censor information that they don't want, censor information that criticizes government policies, particularly this vaccination policy, a vaccine that's been rushed through. And we don't know what the after effects of this vaccine are going to be. For we know that it's worked okay on most people for 6 months. And that's about it. We know that they've said something like 2% could suffer an adverse reaction, and they're trying to set up an AI system to monitor all the adverse reactions. And we know that when they had a vaccine for it was either MERS or SARS, there was a lot of bad effects that came from it, and the company ended up being sued. And we know that these COVID companies that are making these vaccines, they are immune from being sued for these results. So these are all legitimate questions that people have that they're asking. And the government look like they want to silence all of this, and they actually want to criminalize people for pointing this out. And I said this last week, I would really love to see a debate take place, and it would be a real coup for the alternative media to put a debate on between somebody who is pro-vaccination and somebody who is anti-vaccination. I think that would make absolutely riveting viewing. It would get whoever put the debate on masses of numbers, masses of viewers, and it would also enlighten us as to what the arguments are on both sides. I would so much like to see that. But really, the disguise that they've been wearing all along is now just in tatters. You know, all of this is just about censorship, and by linking anti-vax information with hate speech, that's just them admitting that this is just about censorship. That's all. Did you see Neil Basu saying this, Max? Did you have a look at any of this?
I did see that, yeah. I mean, what we've had throughout this entire pandemic is the government not really knowing what it's doing and constantly saying, oh, we're going through an unprecedented period. Well, yeah, we are going through an unprecedented period, and it's fairly obvious that for a lot of the time, the government haven't really known what they're doing, and they've just been bumbling their way forward, making a complete mess of arranging PPI, introducing regulations and rules that were contradictory and that appear to be absurd in people's eyes, introducing restrictions under lockdown that are causing whole industries to go bankrupt. And now they've rushed through, and in their own words, they've rushed through this a number of vaccines now in record short time. And although, you know, if we could be sure that these vaccines were 100% safe, then we'd all be quite pleased that they've been able to rush them through in record time. And it's not just record time, but they've rushed them through in probably less than a quarter of the time it would normally take to develop a vaccine. And so there is good reason to question whether sufficient testing has been done. And the point is that particularly with the very first one, the Pfizer vaccine, information that's come out, and it's in the public domain about the Pfizer vaccine, is that it's an entirely new premise as far as producing a vaccine. Normally, where vaccines are produced, they involve the multiplying of dead virus material and then injecting the dead virus into the bloodstream of the person who's being vaccinated, so that that person's antibodies can can recognize the dead virus and therefore be sensitive to the live virus when it comes along, and can then combat the live virus. And that's the principle upon which vaccination has been done since vaccinations began, as far as I'm aware. What's different with the Pfizer vaccine is that they are proposing to use a little fat a molecule, and inside the fat molecule, they're going to put part of the virus RNA. Now, RNA is, from my understanding, a single strand of genetic material, as opposed to DNA, which is a double strand of genetic material. But what they're proposing to do is to put the live virus genetic material, not the whole virus, but just part of it, into our bloodstream, so that that can then enter the cells that compose our bodies, change our own DNA into a situation where we then produce the little protein corona spikes, so that our immune system can then recognize those as something that's alien, although quite how that helps it to recognize something as alien, I don't know, but and therefore combat the virus. Now, there's a whole lot of difference between injecting a dead virus into somebody's bloodstream in order to stimulate their immune system and injecting live RNA from the virus, because what you're doing is you're effectively genetically modifying the person that's being vaccinated, or so it would seem. And so my concerns with regard to the vaccines that have been produced so far are that what we are appearing to be doing is genetically modifying the entire population, and they're proposing that they produce enough doses of this to inoculate the entire population without there being any proper testing. Now, instead of trying to criminalize people who are anti-vaxxers, what they ought to do is just to address the concerns that the people who are anti-vaxxers have. Now, if I've got it wrong, and they're not proposing to inject live RNA into our bodies so that that live RNA can enter our the cells of our body and change our DNA. If I've got that wrong and that's not the case, then somebody needs to come forward and explain that, and they need to explain why that isn't the case. And if they did that, then that concern that I have would then be overcome. But instead of doing that, what they do is they just attack you as an anti-vaxxer and say, oh, you know, you're questioning whether or not this virus is the right kind of virus, and so therefore we should criminalize that. Now, the subsequent competing vaccines that have been brought forward, and the one that's from Oxford University would appear to be a traditional kind of virus again, the way they've explained the way in which that a traditional vaccine, and the way in which they've explained that vaccine works is that they inject the person being vaccinated with dead viral material. And so from that perspective, that appears to be a vaccine which has been produced in a way which is consistent with the way in which vaccines have been produced in the past. And so therefore, I've got far fewer concerns over the Oxford vaccine compared to the Pfizer vaccine. Now, if we go back to the Pfizer vaccine, if indeed my interpretation of the information that's been released is correct, and they are proposing to genetically modify the entire population, well, before they do that, they need to carry out some long-term tests. And so what they need to do is to have some people who've been vaccinated get pregnant and produce children, and for tests to be done to make sure that those children are still normal, and that the change in the DNA that they're proposing to create so that we can fight the virus doesn't in fact have any kind of side effects that we wouldn't want it to have. And the sort of side effects it could have is that it could, for example, render our children infertile. It could produce any other change you could possibly imagine, because you know, we don't necessarily know whether these bits of RNA are going to be, once they enter our own gene pool and the genetic, once they become a part of the genetic material that exists in our own cells, whether that's going to have any kind of extreme effect. And so if indeed they are proposing to change to genetically modify the people that are vaccinated, then they need to carry out lots more tests and over a much longer period of time. If however, the vaccine is very similar to the basis upon which vaccines have been produced in the past, then, as I say, that's far less alarming. But they need to explain it, and they need to say that this isn't a problem because of this, instead of just turning around and saying, oh, you're questioning it, so therefore, you know, you are an anti-vaxxer, and therefore we should criminalise you. You know, the criminalisation is basically a feature of creeping authoritarianism, and that's one of the things that's is one of the most alarming developments of what's taking place with regard to the way that the government's handling of the pandemic and lockdown, the fact that they're just issuing decrees and then trying to criminalize anybody that questions the decrees that they issue. And we've had the introduction of these £10,000 fines for people who defy lockdown. And what they're using here is extreme punishments for things that people might do, which they could have a very understandable reason for defying lockdown.
Just normal behaviour, isn't it, that they're being fined for? But just to go on to what you were saying there about the Pfizer vaccine, I mean, one way that they could get around that is to just make sure that the people that are given the vaccine are past childbearing age, so they could give the Pfizer vaccine to people that are over the age of 70. And then they could have a control group that are of a younger age to monitor what happens if they're pregnant. Another thing to do with this Pfizer vaccine is it's 15 times the price of the other vaccines, and it has to be kept at -70 degrees as a temperature, and we don't actually have any way of keeping things at -70 degrees apart from in these research centres. Not even hospitals have that ability. So you're talking about a massive infrastructure that has to be put in place there to use this vaccine, this experimental vaccine, which basically tells your body to produce the virus itself. As you say, Max, it genetically modifies the body. And I'm amazed that we've heard nothing about the Russian vaccine. Whenever they talk about these vaccines, they don't include the Sputnik vaccine, which has been around for quite some months now, which appears to be quite safe, which lots of people in Russia have taken. And they're ignoring that. They're just going for the Pfizer one and these other ones that have been produced between Britain and America that are actually going to make an absolute fortune for these pharmaceutical companies. And that's another side of it. You mentioned the creeping authoritarianism there. There's also the finances, the money that is being made out of this by these pharmaceutical companies. That's another question that people have. And another side to it, to these vaccines, because of this, I think people are looking far more deeply into what's actually in these vaccines and how they come about. And a lot of people will say, well, they're made from aborted fetal cells. They're actually made from aborted fetal cells. And the medical companies will say, oh, well, no, it isn't. They're grown from a culture. But those aborted fetal cells were taken back in the 50s, and then they've just kept them going ever since then. It doesn't mean they're not aborted fetal cells just because they've been grown from a culture of aborted fetal cells. That's still what they are. When you're injecting this stuff, that's what you're injecting into your body. It's cannibalism. I mean, it's really very, very sinister. There's a very sinister side to these vaccines that people are looking into. It's a real can of worms that they're tearing the lid off, and that's why they're trying to silence it. We've also had lots of other things to do with COVID as well, but I'll just pass that back over to you, Max, if you wanted to add anything to that, or should we move on to some more of the COVID scam?
I was just going to say that, you know, they've hinted that the Pfizer vaccine is going to genetically modify us, and so that we combat the virus. The vaccine is going to genetically modify us so that we can combat the virus. And I've suggested that, you know, as one consequence, it could produce infertility in our children if we're people of childbearing age. And that sort of testing hasn't been done. And people might say, oh, that's preposterous. Why would anybody think that? Well, the point is that initially we were told that COVID was a relatively harmless disease for people who are younger. And yet what we've now found as time's gone by is that there is long COVID, and long COVID has got all sorts of weird and wonderful features to it that nobody previously anticipated the virus might have. And so people have suffered from long-term neurological problems. They've had problems relating to pain in various parts of their body, etc. So the actual virus itself isn't exactly the same as the cold virus. It's the cold virus with these sort of long COVID effects. And who's to say that the effect of genetically modifying ourselves in order to combat the virus won't have long-term effects that could be quite far-reaching, in the same way that the long COVID effects have been quite far-reaching. And so it isn't just scaremongering to suggest that the vaccine might have some long-term effects. It is perfectly logical to do that. And these are the things that those who are advocating these vaccines, that they need to address, and they need to explain why those concerns are groundless in order to create confidence in the public. And if they're not prepared to create confidence in the public, then it is, you know, going back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier on, it is just bullying to start accusing people who are anti-vaxxers of being criminals. That is just the state bullying us as part of this creeping authoritarianism that I mentioned earlier on.
It's incredibly sinister. One good side to this is that the Daily Mail have started exposing some of the lies that we've been told about COVID. I mean, we've pointed out before, it's all been the alternative media that have been doing this, but now we're starting to see it in the Daily Telegraph and in the Daily Mail. They had a large piece over the weekend. They pointed out that 95% of fatalities to do with COVID actually had underlying causes. They pointed out that the infections actually leveled off before this second lockdown started, which means that we didn't need to have the second lockdown. And this was even pointed out in Parliament, but it was ignored. I mean, Theresa May was one of the people, of all people, that was pointing this out. They pointed out that all the predictions have been completely wrong, and yet they've still continued to have these lockdowns, even though the predictions were wrong. The hospitals are all empty. We've actually got a lower bed count now than we had last year. So there are less beds filled now than there were last year, yet we've been told these hospitals are full. 99.7% of the COVID deaths have been people over the age of 40, and all the deaths altogether are not actually above the average for this time of year. There's not even more elderly dying than there is normally. 1 in 8 infections were actually reported to the wrong authority, with this student situation where the students in the university caught it, because they caught it at university and then they were reporting it, and it was reported in the authority where they actually lived, at home rather than at university. And this has affected these localized lockdowns, so that's all been a great big balls up as well. They've started doing this detection rate in Liverpool, this testing. Everybody's going to be tested in Liverpool, and the actual accuracy rate is only 79% when it's the staff doing it, 73% when it's a health professional doing it, and only 58% when it's members of the public doing it. So half of these tests that they're doing are actually false, and that's before you get onto the fact that they're actually over egging the cake, as it were, by spinning the sample for much longer than it needs to be spun in order to get lots of false positives. And all of this is information that has been covered by organisations like Red Ice. It's also been covered by the Daily Stormer, by conservative sites in America. And now we're seeing the Daily Mail that are starting to point this out and are asking, why aren't the government answering this? What is their answer to this? All this staggering levels of incompetence that we have seen, all these statistics, which are actually not what the government told us they were. We're finding out now that these statistics are the opposite of what the government have told us. And we've also got, they're also making these allegations that the public have been terrified by all of this. And again, that was what the SAGE advisory group told the government they needed to do. They needed to terrify everyone so that we didn't We didn't all die of the doom flu. And yet it's not really been that many people that have died, less than 10% of their prediction. They predicted that 500,000 people, 500,000 people were going to have died by about April. And in actual fact, we're now in November and it's around about 50,000. So it's 10% less. And yet they're still going on with it. I think this is the reason for these vaccines and trying to force everyone to have these vaccines. They sunk everything into this when it started in March, and they really didn't have enough information about it. They were even looking on Wikipedia for the information. That came out last week. So they really were quite terrified about this, and they sunk all this money into research. And then when it came out, that really it's not as dangerous as we thought it was, because they'd already sunk all the money into the research, because they'd already had these lockdowns, I think they just don't want to give it up. They've seen now that they can use it to push this great reset thing across, which the World Economic Forum have come out with, which ties in with Agenda 21 and lots of communist New World Order ideas, and they really don't want to give it up now. So it's good to see that the Daily Mail were exposing this. Did you hear about this article, Max? Did you see it at all over the weekend?
Yeah, I did see that article. But I mean, I think that one of the big motivations is that the governments have panicked. They've introduced all these really severe lockdown measures, which have caused hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people to lose their jobs or to lose their livelihoods, to have their businesses fail, etc. And if they, the only way out of it they can see, where they don't get blamed for doing this unnecessarily and therefore get sued by all the people who've lost their livelihoods, is for them to say, oh, you know, we've come up with this vaccine and we've saved everybody. We've produced enough of this vaccine for everybody to take, and everybody's going to take it because we're going to make sure that they will. We're going to basically insist that we're going to order them to, and then they can claim that they've saved the country. Whereas in reality, if the virus turns out to be less severe than they made out by almost an order of magnitude, and people develop herd immunity, and people, the vast majority of people, realise that they can, that they will survive the illness created by the virus anyway, then then the public will realise that they've been that all these jobs that have been lost, and all this borrowing that has been taking place, and all of the businesses that have failed, all that happened unnecessarily, and I think that there will be hell to pay with people suing the government for their loss of their livelihoods.
I think there may have been somebody over the weekend who said that there could be a class action against the government, a large suit against the government, suing the government for their mishandling of this, and it does look like they're going to encourage people to get vaccinated by saying that if they don't get vaccinated, then they won't get a pass to allow them to go to social events, to travel, or anything like that. So they can still have this excuse of, oh no, we live in a free society, we're not forcing you to get the vaccination, but you won't be able to take part in any social life if you don't have a vaccination. So we've got some troublesome times up ahead, I think, because there really will be some pushback against that. And as you say, Max, we really do need to hear our questions answered rather than being told that we should be criminalized for asking the questions, because they are reasonable questions. And there are lots of people that are asking them. It's not just people that are part of the counterculture that are asking these questions. They're now there in the mainstream press, in the mainstream media. They're being asked in the Daily Mail, and they need to be answered. Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons for this week then, Max? A female greatest Britain? Yeah, we've got a female greatest Briton this week. Somebody, one of the greatest of great Britons, I think, as well. She's influenced the entire world. And I really didn't know that much about her until compiling the notes for this. But it really shouldn't be underestimated what she did. She completely changed the idea of nursing and turned it into a trade and a career and an honourable thing to do. And before she did that, it really wasn't anything. It was just seen as a chore that people had to do. They had to look after people when they were ill or look after people when they were dying. Nobody was actually looking at how they could improve on the way people were, to improve their recovery time and looking at the hygiene of the people. None of this was actually done until the time of Florence Nightingale, who we will be talking about today. She was born on the 12th of May, 1820, and died on the 13th of August, 1910. She was an English social reformer, a statistician, and the founder of modern nursing. And as I say, we really can't underestimate that. She really started the whole idea of nursing. She came to prominence while serving as a manager and trainer of nurses during the Crimean War, in which she organized the care for wounded soldiers. She gave nursing a favourable reputation and became an icon of Victorian culture, especially in her persona of the lady with the lamp, making the rounds of wounded soldiers at night. And she really must have seemed like an angel to these soldiers that were there, that were, maimed and their bodies falling apart. And there's this lovely lady that's coming round that's checking on them, making sure they're okay, making sure that they're fed okay. You know, you really can't underestimate what she did. Do you want to comment on these this brief introduction here, Max?
Well, just to say that everything you've said so far, I firmly believe to be true. I think that she, as we'll demonstrate when we go on to talk more about her, she is somebody who really ought to be an icon of the feminist movement, in fact, because she's somebody who was out of the ordinary for her time, and she was a young lady who was born into quite a wealthy family, and young ladies born into wealthy families during the 19th century were expected to become wives and to marry men and to have children, but she chose to have a career. She was encouraged to study science by her father, and she's somebody who became, as you say, an icon through her the application of her common sense in upgrading nursing from being something that people kind of reluctantly did because they didn't have anything better to do, and upgrading it into a professional career that women can and men can enter into and can sort of look upon with pride.
Well, it does show you that this nonsense that the feminists tell us that women were oppressed and they really couldn't do anything, that's just not true. If women wanted to do something different other than get married and have children, they could do that, particularly if they were wealthy enough to do that. But most women didn't want to do that. And Florence Nightingale was the exception to the rule. And she does prove that the rule is there. The primary function of women is nurturing and to produce children, and it all depends on their nurturing, what that child grows into, and that is the primary role. But there are always exceptions to the rule, and Florence Nightingale was a particularly good exception to the rule. In 1860, she laid the foundation of professional nursing with the establishment of a nursing school at St Thomas's Hospital in London. It was the first secular nursing school in the world and is now a part of King's College, London. So I guess it was always done by nuns and done by churches before then. In recognition of her pioneering work in nursing, the Nightingale Pledge is taken by new nurses, and the Florence Nightingale Medal is the highest international distinction a nurse can achieve. Both were named in her honour, and the annual International Nurses Day is celebrated on her birthday. She was also a prodigious and versatile writer. In her lifetime, much of her published work was concerned with spreading medical knowledge, and many of her tracts were written in simple English so that they could easily be understood by those with poor literary skills. She was also a pioneer in data visualization with the use of infographics, effectively using graphical presentations for statistical data. So she made this information available to the general public. It wasn't just academic textbooks that only doctors could really understand. She made this information available for everyone. She actually increased the life expectancy by about 20 years, pretty much, with what she actually did. It wasn't just in nursing that she was involved in. She was also involved in hygiene in the homes and sanitation and sewage. She had a massive effect in India, massive effect in Britain, in Switzerland, even in America. She was training people that went out to America and brought these ideas over there to America as well. A really wonderful woman. And do you want to comment on that, Max, about the statistics or the infographics that she used as well, that she's known for?
That's right. I think she was a very accomplished mathematician, and this enabled her to do all sorts of statistical analysis in order to prove her theories correct. And she had the sort of infographics was the way in which she presented the statistical material in a graphic form to make it more readily understandable by other people. And it's reminiscent, really, the work that she did. Her life is reminiscent of the career of Francis Galton that we've spoken about before, where, you know, he was celebrated as a polymath, somebody who'd got a very high level of intellectual ability in a wide number of fields. And it also appears that was the case also with Florence Nightingale. Not only was she able to use the experiences that she had in order to benefit just purely nursing, but also the construction of hospitals and the design of sanitation, etc., for people's homes and for other sort of institutions like prisons. And it was her understanding of statistics and her ability to prove her theories through statistics, which is reminiscent, as I say, of Francis Galton, that made her such a prodigious person.
I think she pioneered the use of the pie chart. I think it was invented by somebody else, but it really took off when she started using that. She would use that to illustrate a lot of the information she was trying to get across. Well, let's have a look then in more detail at her life here. Florence Nightingale was born on 12th of May 1820 into a wealthy and well-connected British family at the Villa Columbia in Florence, Tuscany, Italy, and was named after the city of her birth. Florence and her older sister Parthenope studied history, mathematics, Italian, classical literature and philosophy, and from an early age, Florence, who was the more academic of the two girls, displayed an extraordinary ability for collecting and analysing data, which she would use to great effect in later life. She exhibited a gift for mathematics from an early age and excelled in the subject under the tutelage of her father, and later in life became a pioneer in the visual presentation of information and statistical graphs using methods such as the pie chart, which had first been developed by William Playfair in 1801. While taken for granted now, it was at that time a relatively novel method for presenting data. And this is really surprising that she was very good at mathematics, because that's not really something that you find many women that are actually involved in that. It's very unlikely that women are going to be good at mathematics. It's a very masculine thing, and yet she really excelled at that. And when you look at the different disciplines that she was studying, I mean, that's quite incredible. History, mathematics, Italian, classical literature and philosophy, and this was from an early age. And this is what you could do if you had a wealthy family. Then you could afford to be well educated. Obviously her father could afford to get tutors in for them. This was before the age of general education for everyone. So he obviously invested well in his daughters. I should imagine he was a bit disappointed that she didn't marry. She did remain celibate throughout her life, as have some of the men that we've talked about during the time of the British Empire. So it was a shame that she didn't actually produce children, but she did make up for that with all that she did. And you pointed out there as well, Max, that it's a shame that the feminists don't make more of her. She was quite scathing of the feminist types. She didn't see them as being any help at all. She understood that she was the exception to the rule, and what she was doing was different to what most women would have wanted to do, but she certainly wanted to make her mark. Do you want to comment on her early life here, Max?
No, I think we've said all that needs to be said, really, about the attitude of her father encouraging her and her sister in studies, and the fact that she was remarkably proficient in a wide range of different subjects, thereby suggesting that she was perhaps a polymath in the same sense that Francis Galton was, and the use of the use of statistics, as we've already covered, and making statistics not just using statistics, but making those statistics more readily understandable by other people, so that the knowledge that she gained could have wider application, and other people could use her ideas more easily.
Yeah, it's not just knowing this stuff, is it? It's being able to communicate it to others so that it can be shared. Because you're going to have the brightest people, the most intelligent people, but they may not be able to communicate that well. But, you know, we have a lot of geniuses that are very autistic, they're very socially dysfunctional, and they're not really able to make that information available to the wider population. And she wasn't like that. She was able to get this information out there. Well, the most famous part of her life was during the Crimean War, and this is what she's most famous for. Florence Nightingale's most famous contribution came during the Crimean War, which became her central focus when reports came back to Britain about the horrific conditions for the wounded. On the 21st of October 1854, she and a staff of 38 women volunteer nurses that she had trained, including her aunt May Smith and 15 Catholic nuns, were sent to the Ottoman Empire. They were deployed about 295 nautical miles across the Black Sea from Baklava in the Crimea, where the main British camp was based. Arriving early in November 1854 at Selimi Barracks in Skutari, which is modern-day Üsküdar in Istanbul, her team found that poor care for wounded soldiers was being delivered by an overworked medical staff in the face of official indifference. Medicines were in short supply, hygiene was being neglected, and mass infections were common, with many of them proving fatal. There was not even any equipment to process food for the patients. And this reminds me a bit of what Gordon was up against, problems with official indifference. And she was trying to look after our own people. She was trying to look after the British here. I mean, Gordon was concerned with the Sudanese and the Chinese, but even with the British people and the British soldiers, they weren't being looked after, and the fault was with the establishment. Once again, after she sent a plea to the Times for a government solution to the poor condition of the facilities, the British government commissioned Isambard Kingdom Brunel to design a prefabricated hospital that could be built in England and then shipped to the Dardanelles. The result was the Renkoi Hospital, a civilian facility that, under the management of Dr. Edmund Alexander Parks, had a death rate less than one-tenth of that of the Scutari. So 90% of the deaths were avoidable, and it's thanks to her that they were actually avoided. And it was also down to this hospital that Isambard Kingdom Brunel designed. And I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk about him as one of our greatest Britons. Do you want to comment on any of this, Max, and her start here in the Crimean War?
Well, just that field hospitals in those days used to be quite sort of primitive affairs initially. And it's interesting that typhus, typhoid, dysentery and cholera were widespread amongst the troops. What would happen is that the troops would be injured, and lots of them would be brought into a central a centre where they would then be treated. But because of the wounds that they had, infections would set in, and those infections would, because of the lack of knowledge of aseptic technique and things of that sort, those infections would spread very rapidly, and the field hospitals would take on the kind of the sort of appearance of a concentration camp, with lots of very emaciated soldiers who became emaciated because they couldn't hold food down because of the typhoid and typhus that they were, and the dysentery that they were suffering from, and the death rates were very, very high. And it's interesting that during the period of Florence Nightingale carrying out this kind of remedial work in field hospitals in the sort of Ukraine, where this was taking place, Crimea, that those field hospitals were very similar to the concentration camps that came to be a feature of the American Civil War, and that came to be a feature of the war against the war in South Africa against the Boers, and subsequently in the 20th century, the concentration camps that existed across Europe during the Second World War. All of the places where large numbers of people are congregated together, where there are in sanitary conditions, they all develop into places where very large numbers of people die quite unnecessarily. And it's the work that was being done by Florence Nightingale that meant that, certainly as far as field hospitals are concerned, that situation was turned around, and the field hospitals became places where soldiers were taken to recover rather than places where they were taken to die.
I'd like to see the prefab that was designed by Eisenbahn Kingdom Brunel. I bet that looked pretty good as well. During her first winter at Scutari, 4,077 soldiers died there, with 10 times more actually dying from the illnesses, like you just mentioned there, Max, typhus, typhoid, cholera and dysentery, than actually dying from the battle wounds. With overcrowding, defective sewers and a lack of ventilation. Think of that, defective sewers. You've got human waste that's just flowing around the beds. It must have been absolutely disgusting. Because of that, the Sanitary Commission had to be sent out by the British government to Scutari in March 1855, almost 6 months after Nightingale had arrived. So it's thanks to her that she got this Sanitary Commission sent out there. And the commission flushed out the sewers and improved the ventilation. Death rates were sharply reduced by this, but she never actually claimed credit for it and was sure that more could be done due to the poor nutrition, the lack of supplies, the stale air and the overworking of the soldiers. So as you say there, Max, it was changing the place from somewhere that people were put and just left in the hopes that they wouldn't die to being somewhere that people would hopefully be able to recuperate, that had ventilation, that had proper sanitation, where the food was looked at, the supplies were looked at. And stale air was very important as well, you know, getting the ventilation in there, getting the air through there. And this is one of the reasons why people get sick today, is because of all the double glazing. You know, I can remember when I was a kid, you know, I was told, well, you've got to have the windows open. You've got to let the fresh air in. You've got to let these germs get in so that you can fight against them. And now, since we've had all this double glazing, we have a lot of kids with allergies. And I think a lot of that is because they're not exposed to the fresh air enough. Next up, we have an incident where she met Mary Seacole, which is quite famous. And I believe you know quite a bit about Mary Seacole, Max. We'll get into that in a minute. According to some secondary sources, Nightingale had a frosty relationship with her, quote, fellow nurse, Mary Seacole, who ran a hotel hospital for officers. Seacole's own memoir, Wonderful Adventures of Mrs. Seacole in Many Lands, records only one friendly meeting with her when she asked her for a bed for the night and got it. Seacole was in Scutari en route to the Crimea to join her business partner and start their business. However, Seacole pointed out that when she tried to join Nightingale's group, one of Nightingale's colleagues rebuffed her, and Seacole inferred that racism was at the root of that rebuttal. And racism hadn't even been invented by that time. Trotsky hadn't even come up with the term, so I doubt whether she actually used that term. And it refers to this Mary Seacole as a fellow nurse, but of course we've been told that nursing didn't really start until Nightingale started it, so she can't have been a nurse up to the same standard as Florence was. So
I think up to the time of Florence Nightingale, people very often became nurses because they were quite often for religious purposes, because they were nuns, but also where women were widowed and they had no other means of support, and they had no other trade or skill, then they very often would become nurses. Or if they were any women, it tended to be who found themselves with no means of financial support, would often become nurses, and because they had no training, they very often weren't as good as they might have otherwise been. And I think, as far as Mary Seacole is concerned, she was a young woman who inherited a hotel, I think it was, in the Caribbean from an aunt or a grandmother. And she was taught by her mother a number of folk remedies that had come from Africa, because her parents were her ancestry was African through slave roots, and so Mary Seacole was a woman who was typical of the time, somebody who had come into doing work which is comparable to nursing, but who had actually had no proper nursing training whatsoever. And up until her ventures to the Crimea, Mary Seacole had run a hotel in the Caribbean, which was for retired, which was frequented primarily by retired military men who'd gone there to enjoy the tropical climate, because it's beneficial for their wounds or for any medical conditions or whatever that they actually had. And so she had a certain amount of experience of dealing with sick people, but she had never had any formal nursing training whatsoever. And so I think that when she was rebuffed by Florence Nightingale, she was probably rebuffed because she hadn't undertaken any training and probably wasn't prepared to undertake training before she was let loose on actual patients, and probably wanted to just be accepted as if she was a nurse, because she had been doing work that was in some way comparable to nursing in the past.
Now, I think she was out there on a business venture as well. Florence Nightingale was out there volunteering to do this. The response to this, actually, Florence Nightingale actually told her brother-in-law in a private letter that she had been worried about contact between her work and Seacole's business, claiming that while she was very kind to the men, and what is more, to the officers, and did do some good, she also made many of them drunk. I had the greatest difficulty in repelling Mrs. Seacole's advances and in preventing association between her and my nurses, which was absolutely out of the question. Anyone who employs Mrs. Seacole will introduce much kindness, but also much drunkenness and improper conduct. And I would question about this this hotel that she actually had out in the Caribbean, whether it might have partially operated as a brothel. But she certainly wasn't up to the standard of Florence Nightingale, as a nurse. I believe you mentioned something about the fact that they've got a statue or a memorial of Seacole, and actually dwarfs Florence Nightingale's statue somewhere, Max. Is that right?
This is in the wake of the Black Lives Matter issue earlier on this year. What's happened is a campaign grew up amongst the wokearty for Mary Seacole to be celebrated on a par with Florence Nightingale, on the basis that she had an establishment in the Crimea. Mary Seacole's establishment in the Crimea, there wasn't a proper hospital. It was a cross between a hotel, a restaurant, and a general store. And so she sold provisions to the soldiers. She sold them homespun folk remedies for the ailments that they had and the injuries that they had. And she provided a place of lodging for officers who wanted somewhere to rest from the rigors of warfare, and to recover from wounds that they had, and also a place where they could go and eat in kind of restaurant kind of facilities. And so it was a business that she was running. Apparently she did give some of her medical remedies and things to some of the poor soldiers for free. And so, you know, she wasn't a completely she wasn't a bad woman in that respect, but she wasn't a nurse. She was somebody who was running an altogether different kind of establishment to a professional hospital. She was running a kind of an informal kind of rest home, come restaurant, come hotel, basically. And so it was an entirely different thing. But what's happened is that as a result of this campaign that was whipped up by the wokearty in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests earlier on this year, a statue of Mary Seacole has been created, which is larger than the statue of Florence Nightingale that is at St. Thomas's Hospital, and so therefore not only is Mary Seacole set to be celebrated on a par with Florence Nightingale, even though her accomplishments with regard to nursing, etc., are dwarfed by the accomplishments of Florence Nightingale. But Mary Seacole's statue is actually larger and put in a more prominent place than that of Florence Nightingale's, which I think is rather insulting to the memory of Florence Nightingale, especially when we consider that Florence Nightingale wasn't just a nurse. Florence Nightingale was a woman who developed the nursing profession and established nursing as a profession on a par with any other kind of profession in this country, and who did so much more as well with regard to domestic sanitation, etc., as we've already discussed, and who introduced modern scientific methods of evaluation and statistical analysis in order to develop the ideas that she had, which have since been shown to be of great benefit.
I don't think that there's any comparison, is there, really? I mean, this Mary Seacole, she sounds like a good time girl. I look what Florence Nightingale says here: much drunkenness and improper conduct. And what do you think that improper conduct was with these officers going there? They're obviously paying money to stay there at a hotel and eat. And, you know, how does that compare to somebody who volunteers to set up a hospital to look after these people and feed them and make sure that they have clean water and proper sanitation? I mean, it was a business venture that Seacole was involved in. It's just no comparison there. And it's insulting to the memory of Florence Nightingale to put this statue of Seacole there, and also to infer that there was somehow racism was the reason for why she didn't want to be involved with her. And this shows us that black people have had a chip on their shoulder against us all the way back then, 180 years ago, or however far back this was, 100, 150 years ago. She's blaming prejudice and saying that she was somehow being discriminated against by Florence Nightingale, when the fact of the matter is that she had no training, she had a bad reputation, and she didn't want her, Nightingale didn't want her nurses to have anything to do with her or the people that worked with her. She says here, absolutely out of the question. You know, and it's not because she didn't like the colour of her skin, it's because of the drunkenness and the improper conduct that was associated with her. And she says here, I'm sure she was very kind to them, but the problem is she also got them drunk. And how is that going to help you when you are recuperating from wounds? Your drunkenness, I mean, it might give you a brief bit of anaesthesia, but the long-term effects of it are, it's going to be more harmful than good when you're trying to recuperate. So yeah, it's just, you know, it just shows you that this problem that we have, we're trying to mix the races together, it's been going on for forever, basically, and it seems that there's always been this idea that the white man is somehow oppressing the black man, and it's just not true. And we see that here, because she thought she was being oppressed, and in actual fact that wasn't the reason why she didn't want to have anything to do with her. It was just for purely sensible reasons. She didn't want drunkenness and improper conduct. She wanted to run a hospital and improve people's lives, and that would have also given her a bad reputation, wouldn't it? It would have given Florence Nightingale a bad reputation if that sort of thing had been going on there. Well, we should probably leave it here, Max, and continue with Florence Nightingale next week, unless you've got anything else you'd like to add to it this week.
I think it's a good point to pause.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.